Well, who doesn't love a butterfly? We're going to learn a lot more about them with our next guest. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. With us is Wendy Williams. She's a journalist and author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Horse, which was chosen by the Wall Street Journal as a 2015 Best Book of the Year. Her latest work is The Language of Butterflies, How Thieves, Hoarders, Scientists, and Other Obsessives Unlock the Secrets of the World's Favorite Insects. We're going to talk with her about the past, present, and future of butterflies and take your questions. Which butterfly is your favorite? What questions do you have about monarch migration? Well, you can join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcome to the show, Wendy.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, the title of your book has severely cut into our interview time.
I know. I thought it was fun, but then eventually I realized it takes a long time to say it.
It does. No, I was thinking when I was reading through and you were talking about some of the books that the Victorians specifically wrote, they were super long, too. Were you kind of alluding to that?
No, I wasn't really. I don't know. My mind just goes on sometimes, and I just loved. Well, you know, the point of my book is to show the interconnection of nature and nature's net, and I found so many fascinating people over centuries who had been interested in butterflies and figuring out how they worked, and I think I just got really absorbed by those people, not just by the butterflies, but by the people who loved them, who were addicted to them, as I say.
Yeah, definitely. You know? And you, like you said, you did talk to about a lot of amazing people in the book, but I was especially impressed by Maria Sibylla Marion.
Yes, you know, everybody loves her because, and I did, as soon as I read about this, as soon as I read about her, I said, this can't be true. You know, I went, and so then I spent a long time researching her, and I went all the way to the New York Natural History Museum Library to be sure that what I was reading was true. She lived in the 1600s at a time when women were routinely burned as witches for stepping out of line all over Europe and also some places in New England where I live. We know about the Salem witch trials, but she was a unique woman, and she did her own thing. She was so good at it that somehow or other, society just let her do it. So she was not allowed to go to school. She must have been a genius. She was not allowed to go to school or get an education or publish in any kind of formal way because she was a girl. But she managed, she grew up in the household of a man who published books. And her job from a very young age was to hand paint the pictures in these books that her father sold. So she learned art or the trade of art at a very young age and got quite good at it, very skilled at it. At about the age of 13, she began studying caterpillars. I think the reason she did that is because she wasn't really allowed to go outside of her mother's garden and roam the world at large. But she loved to be in her mother's garden, and she seems to have gotten hold of what was called a microscope, but actually it was very primitive and probably more like a magnifying glass than anything. But having that in her mother's garden, she was able to look very closely at the caterpillars that used the plants in her mother's garden. And she noticed that with the microscope, she could see wonderful details, and these caterpillars were actually gorgeous. So she used her art skills and started sketching and painting these caterpillars. And then she noticed that some caterpillars used the same plants all the time. So she drew that. And then later on, she noticed that these caterpillars would make the same kinds of chrysalises when they got to be that time, and then out of these chrysalises would emerge the same kinds of butterflies. So what she basically did, this doesn't sound at all amazing to us.
Right.
Of course, we say, well, of course.
Yeah, duh.
But for those days, the idea that a specific type of caterpillar would make a specific type of chrysalis and emerge as a specific type of butterfly was groundbreaking. No one knew that. In those days, people thought nature was just helter-skelter. As I explained in the book, it was widely believed that women could sometimes give birth to rabbits.
Yes. So it was not a scientific sort of time.
Yes. So she is credited with creating the foundation for our modern science of ecology, because she created the idea of a nature's net. And not just a nature's net, but a dependable nature's net, that this caterpillar will eat this plant and will create this chrysalis and emerge as this butterfly. So, you know, I found, and she did it over 20 years. She did that over 20 years, and she wasn't allowed to publish her findings. So since she had grown up in a publisher's house, she said, fine, I'll make my own book. And she created her own book of 20 years of these drawings, and it became an instant bestseller in Europe.
And you have a couple of her plates in your book, don't you, if I'm not
mistaken?
I do, yes. And they are beautiful.
I wish I had more. I would have loved to have made the whole book out of her. Yes, they're so intricate and so finely done.
Well, I like the fact that in one plate she does the flower, the chrysalis, she does the big butterfly, she does the caterpillars, and even the holes on the leaves. I mean, beautiful.
Yes. It was completely scientifically accurate. Artists before then had painted butterflies and that sort of, you know, plants and that sort of thing, but it was the art wasn't scientifically accurate. It was just a kind of a helter-skelter of look at these beautiful fantasy world plants. Hers was the first to depict it scientifically accurate.
Yeah, very interesting.
What I loved most about her was she moved to Amsterdam, where women were allowed to be cool, even in those days, and she met a very wealthy woman who had collected a lot of butterflies from South America. But she wanted to know not just what dead butterflies looked like. She wanted to know what they did. So she sold all of her artwork and took her daughter, and they bought themselves passage to go to South America and study living butterflies there. This was the first time anyone, not just a woman, the first time anyone had created her own scientific field trip, not funded by a company, not funded by a king or queen or anything like that. She just went because she wanted to find out the answers to her questions.
And this was not an easy journey.
She created another book, too, and that book also became a bestseller.
Yeah, in the 1600s. Crazy. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Steele in Appleton who has a comment for us. Hi, Steele. Steele, turn your radio down. I'm hearing myself.
Yeah.
Steele, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, in the 80s, I learned how to fly in a glider. I was doing some power. And so I have a lot of hours. I was an instructor. And on a magazine, this one other glider pilot said, if you see butterflies, especially monarchs, so this is in '89, and to report it. And I'd been in a sailplane one time, and I was going up like 2,000 feet a minute, and I see this butterfly. It wasn't a monarch, but it went up twice as fast as I did, and this is like. 15,000 feet, and then they make their journeys to Mexico or whatever. What an amazing piece of art.
Well, thank you, Steele. Wendy, that doesn't amaze you, though. You know about those high-flying flights, don't you?
Well, you know what? I do know about them, but it amazes me that the butterfly could ascend so much more quickly than he did.
Right.
No one's ever told me a story like that before. I love that.
Excellent.
They're masters of the wind, you know, as I explain in the book. They use rivers of wind the same way we use rivers to get through continents and, you know, go around obstacles. I would love to know how their brain does that, you know, how they can navigate those winds. But clearly they can, because that's how they get all the way from Canada sometimes all the way down to the mountains of Mexico, and then sometimes get back again.
Yep, just crazy. Well, we've got another call. Russ from Pleasant Springs has a story for us. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, hi. I have currently in the last 5-6 days, I have a monarch butterfly hanging around my front porch. I have a little bit of minor woods behind me, and to my knowledge, I don't have any milkweed on my property. And anyway, this butterfly flits around. If I sit on the porch, it flits around my head. Occasionally, if I put my hand up, it will land on there for a minute or two. When I go out in the morning around 5:30 or 6 o'clock, it is sitting on the outside windowsill quietly with its wings together. And I'm just amazed that it keeps hanging around. And the other question I have is that in prior years, I used to see a very similar size, blackish blue butterfly, but I have not seen that last year or this year. I forget what the name of that was. Looked very similar, but different colorings.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for that observation, Russ. Do monarchs just hang around? I guess we just always think as soon as they're ready to go, they go. But they do hang around, don't they?
Well, you know, there's probably some great nectar plants that he doesn't even know about. You know, I think sometimes people get a little confused. Monarchs must have milkweed in order to lay eggs. And then the caterpillars emerge from the eggs and eat the milkweed, storing away toxins and other kinds of things to use when they emerge as a butterfly. But once they emerge as a butterfly, they don't have to have milkweed. They can nectar on all kinds of plants. So I wonder if that particular butterfly might be there nectaring on all kinds of plants and doesn't have a need to go anywhere. Or it's possible that there is milkweed somewhere there and the gentleman doesn't know it.
Yeah, because sometimes they're kind of hidden away in, and there's a lot of milkweed in Wisconsin, probably not as much as we need, but there's quite a bit of it. So, and as far as that other butterfly that he was talking about, it's really difficult to know which type he saw, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I would not. Mm-hmm. You know, I live in New England.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't know. And the other thing is, once I asked, I live on Cape Cod. I have a Cape Cod butterfly guide that I walk with sometimes. And he's very, very knowledgeable about plants and all kinds of things. So I asked him, when you travel, how do you look for butterflies in other places? And he said, I find a guide there to take me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so specialized. Things are so different, even from Cape Cod and, say, Connecticut or something, that nobody, well, maybe there's someone somewhere.
somewhere.
Very few people would be able to travel to all kinds of other places and identify what they're seeing.
Okay, yeah. And there's a lot of, there's an app for that, I think, and there's books, too, so maybe that'll be helpful to Russ. We've been talking about butterflies with Wendy Williams. She's the author of the new book, The Language of Butterflies, How Thieves, Hoarders, Scientists, and Other Obsessives Unlock the Secrets of the World's Favorite Insect. What questions do you have about those amazing insects? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. We're talking about butterflies with Wendy Williams. She's an award-winning author and journalist, and her latest book is The Language of Butterflies, How Thieves, Hoarders, Scientists, and Other Obsessive Unlocked the Secrets of the World's Favorite Insects. What would you like to know about butterflies? Are you concerned about their future? Well, we'd like you to be part of our conversation, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And Wendy, we were talking about monarchs before we had to break for the news, and we've got Marty in Kenosha with a call about them. Hi, Marty.
Greetings. I have a large proliferation of milkweed on the side of my house, and over the last few years, it's become a ritual for me to go out in the springtime and look for caterpillars. And I turn over the leaves, you know, and see something chewed through, and there it is. And I'm wondering, were these eggs laid like in the sometime last year and they're hatching now? Or were they laid early this spring and they are hatching now?
Okay, thanks, Marty. Wendy, how does that work?
No, they wouldn't have survived over the winter, especially in Wisconsin, which I hear is very cold.
It can be.
what happens is the butterflies migrate south, and starting in late August, they go all the way south, and they most of them, but not all of them, because as I say in my book, there's always exceptions. Most of them fly over the Mexican border, and then they make a right turn and head up into the Mexican mountains just before they get to Mexico City. They overwinter there. They go into a kind of a torpor state, but they're still active. They still fly. They still enjoy the sunshine, but they don't do much until the weather becomes a little bit warmer sometime in mid-February. Then they begin the process of migrating back. That's when they start to lay eggs, not before they migrate, although some do, but most of them will lay eggs after their overwintering process. So the first group of eggs that are laid are usually either in northern Mexico or in Texas. Texas is really important for the monarch population. Then those eggs will mature into go into chrysalises and mature into monarchs, and those monarchs will fly further north again, and then they will lay eggs somewhere a little bit south of Wisconsin, most likely, and then the third group of butterflies will go all the way up to Wisconsin, and there they will lay eggs. So Wisconsin is one of the last areas in North America to have eggs laid. So they come a little bit later there than they would in Texas, certainly. And after about 3 to 5 days, those eggs have matured enough that caterpillars eat their way out, and that caterpillars go through certain stages, and then after a certain period of time, they go into chrysalises and they emerge again as monarchs. And it may well be that the monarchs that emerge in Wisconsin are among the group of monarchs that fly south in late August. But eggs would never be able to survive. Some caterpillars and butterflies do lay eggs that survive the winter, but monarchs do not. They wouldn't be able to survive the cold temperatures.
Okay. And it's kind of interesting, I thought, when I was reading about those, the little eggs, and they're teeny, teeny, tiny, and the little caterpillars come out. And some of them, because they're eating the latex of the milkweed, that they actually glue their little mouths together and they die.
Isn't that sad? Well, you know the old phrase, nature raw in tooth and claw. A huge proportion of the caterpillars that emerge from these eggs don't make it to the butterfly stage. The milkweed, they're condemned to eat this milkweed, and it's not easy to eat milkweed. Anybody that's ever handled milkweed will know if you tear apart a leaf, there will be this sticky, gooey substance that will come out of the leaf, and if you get it on your fingers, you might get your fingers stuck together.
Yep.
But not only is it sticky, the poor things get their jaws shut or they get their feet stuck and can't get free, but it's also toxic.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's so toxic that the butterflies can't survive the toxin. But if they're lucky enough to survive the toxin, then that toxin is stored away in their bodies, and it stays there as they transform into butterflies. And it's that toxicity in the butterflies that protects them from predators. So, you know, nothing is black and white in this world. Nothing is simple.
That's for
sure. So the very plant that they need to survive is also the very plant that sometimes kills them.
Yeah, it really is a really amazing book. And anybody who likes butterflies is a little bit interested, you will not be able to put this down. It was so, again, you go all over the place. You talk about the past, you know, insects, butterflies have been around a lot longer than we have. So you go way back to what's going on today. And the cover is absolutely gorgeous because it's iridescent. Yeah.
You know, I had to, when they sent me the cover, I was just thrilled.
Oh.
But I got a lot of emails and messages through. I have a Facebook page if anyone wants to join up. A lot of messages through Facebook that said, oh, this is not true. This is a photoshopped kind of thing, and these butterflies would never do that. But I finally found the actual photo from Yay. Which that cover is taken. And I found the photographer, and I emailed him, and I said, could you tell me the circumstances under which the photo was taken? And he emailed back and said, no.
Oh,
I thought, oh my God, because I'm dying to know. I mean, sure. It looks like a real photo. They're, you know, these yeah. butterflies apparently do. These are called leks, where the males compete with each other, I guess, for beauties to see if mm-hmm. the females like them the most. I'm not sure because I can't find out the circumstances.
Well, it makes for a beautiful cover for sure. So you can't miss it when it's sitting on a shelf because it's very pretty, very blue. And like I said, it's iridescent. So it's really neat. We do have another call. Kenneth in Janesville has a question. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I've wondered all my life, how did the butterfly get named?
You know, that's a mystery lost in the mists of time. There are a lot of speculative ideas, but no one really knows for sure. Some people say that the word butterfly came from, is a derivation from German. Some people say that it was called a butterfly because they were referring to the little cabbage whites that are pretty common and that would get in the way when they were trying to turn butter. But nobody knows. Of course, one thing people love to do is to turn those two words around and say butterfly is from flutter by. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves that.
Yeah.
It's a mystery. I have never been able to nail that down.
And we probably never will. But thanks for the question, Kenneth, because it's kind of, it's interesting. It's another secret of the butterfly world.
Everybody wants to know. Everybody asks that question.
Do they really? Well, yes, I hadn't written it down, so I'm glad Kenneth did. One thing that I wanted to talk about, because I've always thought that I knew how to tell the difference between butterflies and moths. You know, the mm-hmm. moths have those little furry antennae or whatever. But that's not the case, is it? How do you tell the difference?
Well, you know, what I write about a couple of times in the book is that when it comes to butterflies and insects in general, we can write about rules of thumb,
yep.
but there will always be exceptions. And that is definitely true for butterflies and moths. Everything that I was told about how to identify a butterfly as opposed to a moth turned out to be wrong. I went to the Natural History Museum at Harvard up in Boston, and I spoke to a wonderful woman who curated the collections there, not the historic collections, but the current collections, and she brought out a box and showed me 8 insects, and she said, tell me which one is the butterfly and which one is the moth, and I was wrong every single time using those rules of thumb. Generally, the moths have furry antennas, and generally butterflies have clubs on the end. Well, they're not clubs. They're little knobs,
yeah.
I guess you'd say, on the end of the antennae. But I used that rule, and I made a mistake. Generally, butterflies are slender and a prejudiced way of saying it is elegant, and
uh-huh.
moths are fat and furry and unpleasant, but I was wrong there. And sometimes, you know, generally the rule is that butterflies fly during the day and moths fly during the night, but I was wrong about that. There are some moths that actually fly during the day. So the one thing that does seem to hold true for most species is that moths have a frenulum, which is a little kind of a hook and eye system that holds the forewing and the aft wing together in moths, but butterflies don't have that. So they fold their wings a little bit differently when they're resting.
So you have to get pretty close.
I'm sure close. There'll be an exception to that somewhere,
too. I'm sure too. There is, too. And that kid can't come up all the time in your book. There's always an exception to one of these so-called rules. So.
Right. I love that.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we've got another call from Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick. Nick, are you
right
with us?
There.
There you are. Yep. Okay. What can we help you with?
I want the butterfly's life in the winter, just go on fly down to Mexico and, you know, just hang out and do nothing and come back in the summer. That'd be awesome. But my question is, my daughter wanted a butterfly house, so we bought it. But I work a lot of hours and I haven't had a chance to put it up. Is it just a little too, I'm assuming it, from what your statements were earlier, it's just a little too late to put that up. But if I put it up, are they going to actually use that?
What's your knowledge
I'm not really
on that?
Sure what a butterfly house is. I've never
it's kind of like a birdhouse, but has slits in it for the butterflies to go in. I've seen them. I have no experience as to whether they work or not. I'm sure one of our listeners does, though. So if you do, give us a call, or you can write an email. That might be easier. ideas@wpr.org. That'll be interesting to find out.
Well, I'm going to find out about it, too. I guess the way for him to think about his question is to find out what kind of species will be drawn to this butterfly house. And if they're still flying, then they might use it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, you know, one of the things that it's important for people to know is that not all butterfly species fly all summer long. Some of them may fly for a couple of weeks, and then they may take a couple of weeks off, and then a whole new group of butterflies of the same species may fly a few weeks later. So I'm not sure what butterflies would be drawn to such a butterfly house, but if they're still flying, I don't know why he couldn't try it.
Yep, absolutely. It's not going to hurt anything. So,
no.
Yeah. Let's go to Keith in Madison. He's got a question about monarchs, too. Hi, Keith.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering how the monarchs navigate when they're finding flowers to feed on. Do they do it by sight or smell? Sometimes they'll fly around and there's flowers right there, but they won't land on them. And I'm just wondering if they do it, how they're finding flowers to feed on.
You ask a wonderful question. I spend some chapters in the book writing about how monarchs and other butterflies navigate. But I don't think the answer to that question exists in a lot of detail. What has been shown is that butterflies have amazing eyes. They don't see the same way that we see because they don't see one picture that is integrated into an entire image in their brain. But they see colors really, really well, and that's part of the theme of my book. The language of color is their language. So they will be using color, and they will be drawn to specific colors. Some specific butterflies will be drawn to those specific colors. But they also seem to use aroma, and they can sense that partly with their antennae. And sometimes when they land on a plant, they can amazingly, they can taste the plants a little bit with their feet. So they have all kinds of complicated mechanisms that are different from the ones that we use. But in some ways, we can relate. I know color is important because if there's a butterfly that likes a particular color of flower and you happen to have a shirt on that has that same flower, that same color, they may well come over and investigate you. That happened to me just the other day. I was in Western Massachusetts watching a butterfly that was drawn to a bright red berry, and I wasn't really thinking about it, but I had the same bright red color on my shirt, and the butterfly came over and investigated me for quite a while and said, no, I don't think she's going to taste very good. and then I saw when in another place during the monarch migration, a man was wearing an orange baseball cap that was exactly the color of other monarch butterflies. And he had a monarch that flew over to him and stayed with him for quite a while before, I guess, the monarch decided, no, that wasn't really another butterfly or a flower. So the color does hold an important power over their neurology.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Keith. That was really interesting. Let's go to Cheryl in Conover. She has a comment for us. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, it's a great show. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
We had purchased a house in, we live in northern Wisconsin, which is very similar to upstate New York, for your guests. And in northern Wisconsin, I have 2.5 acres, and they used to mow all 2.5 acres. And when we bought the house, I said to my husband, no, we're not doing that. We're only mowing in and around the house, and that's it. And then we have a fenced-in yard for our dog. And so in light of that, I wound up with a wonderful milkweed patch that not only produces caterpillars, but the bees are having a ball. So between the bees and the butterflies, and then late in the summer, right about the first or second week of August, last year, we counted them. I had 35 monarch butterflies in my patch of milkweed hanging out, flying around. I've never seen anything like it. I tried to get... It's just beautiful. Just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Oh, that's great. Great, Cheryl. And you can. She's really excited about this, Wendy. And people don't they?
I'm excited to hear her story. I think that's a wonderful story.
Yep.
And that she managed to create this just by saying don't mow the plants. You know, sometimes mowing is okay, but you have to mow at the right times. And if what you want are monarch butterflies, the right time is probably not just when the milkweed is growing. But I'm not surprised to hear that about the bees, because there are many, many different insects that use milkweed. It's not just monarchs. There are a lot of insects that use milkweed. And how, congratulations to her that probably without even knowing it, she bought some land that already had milkweed on it. Starting milkweed growing is a difficult process.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was right there, and all she had to do was figure out not to mow it down.
Yep.
If you plant it, they will come.
Yes, they will. And once it gets started, it really goes. So, yeah, be prepared for lots of milkweed plants. So. You know, we didn't get a chance to talk, but let's talk a little bit right now about the actual wings of a butterfly. You have some pictures in your book that are super magnified. Explain a little bit about them and how they produce the color that they do.
You mean about the scales?
The scales, yeah.
Yes, the scales were really, really interesting to me. You know, what I did in this book was try to find unexpected scientific research on butterflies over the past 10 years. And what I found out about the scales, the researchers who are studying the shapes of the scales, was absolutely mind-boggling. This, first of all, the scale itself is not alive when it appears on the butterfly wing. It's dead, but it starts growing as a live cell, and when it emerges and creates a scale, then it solidifies. So anyone who's ever seen a picture of a living cell knows that the encapsulation of that cell is actually very flexible. Kind of, one scientist described it to me as kind of like a garbage bag.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, that it holds everything inside it. But when it emerges as a scale, it hardens. And these scales harden into various, very intricate shapes. You would never be able to see these shapes with anything except a really powerful modern microscope. But what researchers have discovered is that these wonderful colors, not the browns and tans, those are made from pigments, but the wonderful colors on the tops of the butterfly wings are the result of the shapes of these scales when they harden. What they're actually doing is bending the light. They're bending the light. Some of the colors in the light are eliminated, but other of the colors are reflected back out for you to see. So you're not really looking at pigment. You're looking at a shimmering of light, and I think that's the reason why we love to look at them so much, because they shimmer. Anyone who likes to blow bubbles, children love to blow bubbles and look at the colors in the sky. Those are the kinds of colors that butterflies are showing on the tops of their wings. Or if you look at a little bit of oil on a water surface and you see those colors fluctuate and you look at those, our eyes love color. That comes from deep, deep, deep in our evolutionary heritage. Just the way you put a mobile over a baby's crib and the baby will reach up for these glittering colors. We still do that as adults. We just don't know we're doing it.
Exactly. Well, it was a wonderful book to read, Wendy. I recommend it for anybody who has got a friend who likes butterflies, or if you like butterflies, to get a copy of it. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for liking my book.
You bet. Our guest has been Wendy Williams. Her book is called The Language of Butterflies. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to talk about the life of an immigrant, first through the eyes of an author, and then at 11:45, we'll learn what agriculture migrant workers experience when they're here in Wisconsin. And if you want to know more about our show, please go to the Larry Mueller blog. You can go to WPR.org/Larry, and there'll be a link for our blog, all kinds of really neat, interesting articles. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Stay well.